boring and menial day job. Though wealthy, he was not spoiled, and would become more excited when he recounted one of his many outdoor adventures involving biking or canoeing. Sometimes bored at school and having spent a fair bit of time online, he joined Non-Ops in the fall of 2010 during the first phase of Operation Payback. He recounted, "I got involved because I read some article somewhere and thought, oh man, dem hacks are cool." Then it was so much more than that. Though far from being a talented hacker, he was still technically proficient. One might even say a quintessential geek. As he sailed along in the anonymous ship, he accrued new skills, security protocols, and database and web server management. But the biggest things I learned, he said, were not technical. Teamwork and organization are massive. He was one, among four I met, of those organizers and brokers essential to making Anonymous's clock tick, a device which resembled Dali's gooey melting clocks more than a Swiss machine. For much of the fall of 2010, Adnan was an avid spectator on IRC, only occasionally chipping in on organizational matters. But he chatted, especially with other channel operators such as Joe Pye. Finally, late in December, Adnan pitched a proposal, aided by those he had talked to for long hours. The proposal forever altered the course of Anon-Ops. His suggestion was simple. Use anonymous resources to publicize the plight of the Tunisians revolting, at the time, against their president-slash-dictator Ben Ali, who had been in power since 1987. In his own words, "We had this Pound Anon news channel, and there was like three of us as moderators. One of the guys there, who I think was Tunisian, said something like, 'This kid burned himself about this, and there's a few people doing some small protests. It would be cool to do something.'" The Tunisian government had by then already blocked the diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks, which created an enticing and urgent bridge for a cohort of geeks. Some channelgoers initially insisted it was insane to take on a government. Adnan let it go. A week later, on New Year's Eve, Adnan was on holiday with his family. With a blizzard roaring outside, he sneaked away and jumped online from his hotel room. He pushed back against the naysayers, bolstered by a sense of righteousness, and also a dose of misinformation and misunderstanding. I, being oblivious to the actual size of the moral fag Anons, assumed there were thousands of active members and said, why not? It is true there were thousands during Operation Avenge Assange, but the consistent number ran only in the hundreds, and those working specifically on propaganda and technical matters numbered even fewer, and were shrinking. But he kept pressing, and eventually enough of them were convinced. Adnan, "We just spammed the shit out of the link to the channel Pound Op Tunisia everywhere. People were bored. It was a crazy idea." Many joiners were still skeptical. As Quinn Norton reported for Wired, many didn't think either the op or the revolution had a chance. But it turned out to be one of the group's most stellar operations, ushering in a transformation from anonymous to anonymous everywhere. No longer was the group bound to internet-y issues like censorship and file sharing. A day or so after Adnan resurrected the proposal, he received a private message, PM, on IRC, from someone on Pound Internet Feds, offering their many services, web defacements, DDoSing, hacks. Maybe this would be easier than he thought. On January 2nd, 2011, at the dawn of a new year, always a sign of hope, Anonymous published the following press release inaugurating Pound Op Tunisia, eventually translated into French, Arabic, Spanish, and Italian. "A time for truth has come, a time for people to express themselves freely and to be heard from anywhere in the world. The Tunisian government wants to control the present with falsehoods and misinformation in order to impose the future by keeping the truth hidden from its citizens. We will not remain silent while this happens. Anonymous has heard the claim for freedom of the Tunisian people. Anonymous is willing to help the Tunisian people in this fight against oppression. It will be done. It will be done. This is a warning to the Tunisian government. Attacks at the freedom of speech and information of its citizens will not be tolerated. Any organization involved in censorship will be targeted and will not be released until the Tunisian government hears the claim for freedom to its people. It's on the hands of the Tunisian government to stop this situation. Free the net and attacks will cease. Keep on that attitude, and this will just be the beginning. The tiger consumes 4 chickens a day. But let's back up to the onset of revolution itself. Mohamed Bouazizi, Nawat WikiLeaks, and Chelsea Manning all deserve thanks for its inception. In 2010, living under the Ben Ali regime since 1989, scores of Tunisians were downtrodden, living in deplorable conditions, and fearful as human rights abuses, torture, censorship, and detentions intensified in the country. The country had not been party to any large-scale protests for decades, and its many Western allies, including the United States, singled Tunisia out as a model of political and economic stability in an Arab region otherwise known for strife and uncertainty. So when revolution hit, and when the mainstream media finally reported on it with substance, it came as a shock, for Westerners at least. The demonstrations led to one of the quickest dictatorial downfalls in recent times and spread as a chain reaction across the region, becoming what is now called the Arab and African Spring. Like so many revolutionary moments, hindsight reveals that there had been, in plain view, enough despair to fuel a fire of defiance for weeks. All that was missing was a match. In Tunisia, 2 presented themselves. First, on November 28th, when WikiLeaks released its first batch of 220 diplomatic cables, they made the shrewd decision to partner with local activist and media outfits around the globe. One was in Tunisia. Nawat WikiLeaks provided them with Tunisia-specific cables. 3 Nawat members translated the cables into French and published them under the banner of TuniLeaks to coincide with WikiLeaks' larger public release of documents. Nawat also worked with foreign geeks and hackers to ensure that their website with the cables remained online in the face of vigorous attempts by the government to censor it. The cables confirmed what was widely known but theretofore undocumented as fact. Ben Ali was rotten to the core, his regime was mired in corruption, and his family lived in opulence while the rest of the country struggled to meet its daily needs. The widely available proof of government corruption and hypocrisy based on an unstoppable flow of leaks was significant in fanning the flames of anger and agitation among citizens throughout the region, wrote Ibrahim Saleh, an expert on Tunisian politics. Many Tunisians read these cables, duly noting the exact number of chickens fed to a pet tiger and the 3 types of juices served at dinner, one of which was kiwi, hard to procure in the country. 12s. The dinner included perhaps a dozen dishes, including fish, steak, turkey, octopus, fish couscous, and many more. The quantity was sufficient for a very large number of guests. Before dinner, a wide array of small dishes were served, along with 3 different juices, including kiwi juice, not normally available here. After dinner, he served ice cream and frozen yogurt he brought in by plane from Saint-Tropez, along with blueberries and raspberries and fresh fruit and chocolate cake. 13s. El Materi, Ben Ali's son-in-law, has a large tiger, Pasha, on his compound, living in a cage. He acquired it when it was a few weeks old. The tiger consumes 4 chickens a day. Comment: the situation reminded the ambassador of Uday Hussein's lion cage in Baghdad. El Materi had staff everywhere. There were at least a dozen people, including a butler from Bangladesh and a nanny from South Africa. 19s. Most striking of all, however, was the opulence with which El Materi and Nesrine live. Their home in Hammamet was impressive, with the tiger adding to the impression of over-the-top. Even more extravagant is their home still under construction in Sidi Bou Said. That residence, from its outward appearance, will be closer to a palace. It dominates the Sidi Bou Said skyline from some vantage points and has been the occasion of many private, critical comments. The opulence with which El Materi and Nesrine live and their behavior make clear why they and other members of Ben Ali's family are disliked and even hated by some Tunisians. The excesses of the Ben Ali family are growing. Second, on December 17, 2010, 3 weeks after Nawat.org released the translated cables, an unrelated act of desperation ripped open the soul of the nation. Bouazizi, a young fruit and vegetable seller, was accosted by the police, who seized his unlicensed food cart and refused to return it even after Bouazizi offered to pay the fine. His first attempt at retrieving his cart was a frustrating failure. Low-level government officials refused to even talk to him. Doubly insulted, and with a family of eight to feed, he set himself on fire. Powerless and voiceless in one moment, he became, in the next, impossible to ignore, but at the terrible cost of his life. Protests began in Sidi Bouzid, the city where Bouazizi resided. Quickly, they radiated out in every direction. Lives were lost at the hand of the police, causing more people to join in the protests. Takriz, an internet-savvy group chartered as a mailing list in 1999, worked to connect the rough-and-tumble street youth to the internet. Though Takriz had no direct connection with Anonymous, they were kindred spirits. A network of a few thousand, Takriz generally refuses to cooperate with journalists, bandies about obscenity as a shock tactic, and proudly embraces anonymity. Its current Twitter account reads, "Tunisian Cyber Think/Fight Tank and Street Resistance Network since 1998. Free, true, and anonymous. Takrizo ergo sum. We make revolutions." Bouazizi passed away from his burns on January 4, 2011, and the next day an estimated 5,000 mourners attended his funeral, many of them chanting, "Farewell, Mohammed, we will avenge you. We weep for you today. We will make those who caused your death weep." The next day, 75% of the nation's lawyers went on strike, calling for an end to the crackdown. Tunisians from all walks of life, teachers, union members, students, joined the fray. Protests continued to spread, and police violence escalated. By January 13th, dozens of journalists, bloggers, and activists had been arrested, and over 60 protesters had been killed. By the middle of the month, Ben Ali decreed a state of emergency, but it was impossible to contain the fury. However, reading the Western mainstream media at the time, one would have barely known. After all, you do not have to wear a mask to do it. The North American and European public first got word of the protests from the publication of a brief Associated Press story on the riots. The report was understandably lacking in detail, as the revolts had just broken out. With each passing day, even as the protests intensified, the reporting in the mainstream Western media outlets, with a few minor exceptions, remained tepid. On January 9, 2011, with Anonymous already engaged in Tunisia, acting as digital courier pigeons to get word and videos out from the trenches to the public at large, the AP published another story, picked up by newspapers like the New York Times and the Globe and the Mail, parroting Ben Ali's position. People taking part in the spate of unrest say they are angry at a lack of jobs and investment, but officials say the rioting is the work of a minority of extremists intent on damaging the North African country. Ben Ali would flee less than a week later, on January 15, 2011. As part of its campaign, Anonymous wrote the following letter to journalists. "It has come to our attention that the ongoing riots in Tunisia have, by and large, escaped the notice of reliable Western news networks. It is the responsibility of the free and open press to report what the censored press cannot. The public demonstrations, as well as the actions Anonymous has taken in solidarity with the citizens of Tunisia, demand mainstream coverage. The Tunisian government, led by President Ben Ali, has shown an outrageous level of censorship, not only blocking the websites of dissident bloggers, but also sites like Flickr and any website or news source mentioning WikiLeaks. In a show of blatant disregard for the guaranteed right of free speech, over the past 24 hours, the Tunisian government officials have hacked email and Facebook accounts of anyone who has taken actions labeled as activism, which may be as dangerous as planning a protest or as innocent as commenting on a discussion board for a WikiLeaks-related group. Entire Facebook accounts have been commandeered by the Tunisian government, who have even gone so far as to change profile pictures to a pirate ship in a mockery of those who stand for freedom of speech. Anonymous, in turn, has launched DDoS attacks against the websites of the Tunisian Prime Minister and his corrupt government, the stock market, and the primary DNS server of Tunisia, thus successfully bringing down many of the websites ending in .tn, Additionally, we have taken steps to ensure that Tunisians can connect anonymously to the internet and access information that their government does not want them to see. There has been an almost complete absence of prominent coverage. We ask, why is a news source like Al Jazeera one of the few covering these earth-shaking riots while the rest remain quiet? The world is getting the impression that unless Western economic interests are involved, our media does not care to report upon it. Perhaps you didn't know? Now that you do, you can help us spread the news. After all, you do not have to wear a mask to do it. Sincerely, Anonymous. Dudes, believe me, the key of this is having no ego. But Anonymous was doing more than pestering the mainstream media to do its job. By January 2, 2011, a technical team on Pound Internet Feds forsook their holidays to work nonstop. Indeed, Adnan told me he barely slept for 2 weeks. In an interview, he explained that the operation took a different approach than Operation Payback and Avenge Assange. Adnan, with Tunisia, we had a plan. We thought carefully about what to do and when in a small group, presented a list of options in a poll, then took the result of the poll. It was much less a big group decision than other ops. Op Tunisia marked, both internally and externally, a sea change. All throughout the fall, multiple secret cabals and channels had populated Anonymous. Even Chanology had to reckon with Marble Cake, a cabal of its very own. While those in secret channels wielded technical power, and in many respects called the shots, they were still beholden to those in the public channel if they wanted to get things done. The angry masses of the IRC body politic kept the cabals in check, a message made clear when, earlier in the fall, the masses rose up in a collective shitstorm at Pound Command's attempts to cease DDoSing in response to the Pirate Party. The managing of Op Tunisia was different. From the beginning, a handful of smaller teams composed of hackers, propaganda makers, and organizers led the operation and never let go. It was not that this team-based model displaced other mass modalities of organizing. There were other simultaneous operations, some of which originated from the public channels with no cabal involvement, and a public IRC channel attached to Op Tunisia existed and played a valuable role. On January 2, 2011, a hacker named Rubik, not his real pseudonym, who had been working on two private channels, swooped in to announce that a Tunisian website had been defaced. All pseudonyms have been changed. Rubik, pm.gov.tn/pm/index.php, defaced. OT, way to go, Anons! Way to fucking go! Rubik, fucking A, nice job. OT, more to come, biatches. Rubik, marchepublique.gov.tn also. KRAD, pm.gov.tn and marchepublique.gov.tn de-fucking-faced. Laughdye, by the way, mad props on the lolcats. pm.gov.tm/pm/index.php. Vivom, pm.gov.tn/pm/index.php. Booyah, motherfuckers. A group of hackers had been hard at work, cooperating as a team for some time. Yet the majority of journalists couldn't resist the opportunity to pinpoint a mastermind or leader, the architect ostensibly maneuvering everyone else. Ironically, an internet search for anonymous leader will yield at least four different names. Eventually, most journalists identified Sabu and Topiary as the leaders, most likely because they erroneously conflated their robust public relations presence with organizational or dictatorial control. Although many articles single out a ringleader or a mastermind, the exact nature of what this entails is left largely unstated. The reader is left to use his or her own imagination, perhaps envisioning an elite villain sitting on a high-backed chair in some ice palace, stroking a cat on his lap, as a deep echoing laugh reverberates slowly through the chambers. Adrian Chen surmised, based on leaked IRC logs, that Sabu plays the role of a leader, enforcing unit discipline while the other members stand by. And yet Chen himself belies this insight in the next breath by shifting attention to a related hack performed without Sabu's input by another group of Anons. Analyzing a single log for evidence of a leader is about as effective as extrapolating the entire plot of a movie from a single still frame. Yet The Guardian's Charles Arthur made the same error, writing, "For some time after the UK arrests, the only visibly active member of Lull's sect remained its leader, known online as Sabu, who would simultaneously deny that he was its leader and then use phrases such as, 'my team.'" But broader context reveals that Sabu was simply referring to the Pound Pure Dash Elite channel he created long ago and described by other Lulzsec members as an IRC channel where friends of Lulzsec could hang out. As it turns out, hacker undertakings, especially within Anonymous, tend to be dynamic and fluid, with multiple individuals or even groups working in concert. What holds true for one operation may not for the next. Sometimes a particularly obsessive hacker engenders, for a time, an organized collective workflow. At other times, it is chaos and miscommunication. Indeed, when I interviewed Jeremy Hammond in prison much later, he bemoaned, "I wish we were more like Red Hack, more disciplined." Red Hack, a Turkey-based hacktivist group, has a clear hierarchy, a leader, and a spokesperson. Products each of 16 years of organizing and a shared devotion to Marxist-Leninist tactics. Maybe Anonymous could have achieved more had it had a leader or a static hierarchy. Hackers tend to suffer from what I like to call geek distraction disorder, GDD. Without oversight, a hacker could easily wind up in a field surrounded by yaks with a shaving razor in hand, wondering how he got there. If you understand this reference, you are at risk. But it is equally probable that Anonymous achieved so much precisely because there was no boss pointing to a fixed destination. Whatever the case, the work unfurled organically. Depending on who was on the channel, what each participant could contribute, and this willingness, in a certain moment, to learn something new, the crucial ingredient of most any successful hack. Optunesia illustrates this all so well. Imagine yourself on IRC, and Anon witnessing the operations beginning. It is January 2, 2011, and you are working directly with Tunisian activists and hackers who are feeding you unvarnished information about a historic revolt. You are at home, sitting largely still except for your fingers moving at the keyboard, but the information you receive enables responses that can make a direct difference in the event, just one step removed from the people on the ground throwing Molotov cocktails. Your contributions won't necessarily be significant, but they can't be overlooked. They are personally empowering, a mechanism of solidarity, and, in some cases, perhaps even a real boon that shields those on the ground from harm. All of this depends on shifting, messy modes of cooperation, and sets the stage for organizations to spring up around a particularly good idea and to fall apart at even a hint of disagreement and alternate paths. At this time, there were two different and private IRC channels that were active simultaneously, Pound Op Deface and Pound Internet Feds. The latter is where the heavy technical lifting was done, the former where organizers congregated. A gopher shuttled news between them. Some hackers were in the know, while others were continually arriving. All pseudonyms have been changed. Rubik. K-Rad, any good with Postgres SQL? Postgres SQL is a database. pm.gov.tn/pm/redirect-b.php?id=54&IDB=3?2 K-Rad. Rubik, I've never messed with Postgres SQL. It is even the first time I've ever seen it on a box, to be honest. Gibnut, why are we hitting up Tunisia? K-Rad, because they've just passed a law which says the media can't say what they want and banned them from mentioning WikiLeaks? Gibnut, K-Rad, thank you. Time to own Tunisia, then. On other channels, users suggested DDoS campaigns, but both in Anonymous and out, there were those who prided themselves on being real hackers and dismissed DDoS as lame, or even detrimental to real hacks, as we will see in a moment. Real hackers find exploits. People who just run Loic are considered beneath the hacker moniker, mere script kiddies or skiddies for short. Gipnot announces that he has a zero day, which is much more powerful. A zero day exploit, or O-Day, as people sometimes jokingly call it, is a previously unknown security vulnerability in a piece of software. It is called a zero day because it is unknown by the public, or the software authors who could fix it, for 0 days and counting. A zero day is gold. Anyone who knows the zero day can exploit it over and over until it is patched. The most coveted zero days provide access to a computer or network, which is why they are sold for high profit in a thriving black market. Many, many governments participate in this ethically problematic market, including the U.S. government, who, according to technology reporter Joseph Menn, has become the biggest buyer in a burgeoning gray market where hackers and security firms sell tools for breaking into computers. The U.S. government largely purchases zero days from private firms that spend at least tens of millions of dollars a year just on exploits. Suffice it to say, Gibnut's news was received with excitement. Gibnut, let's see fuck Loic, we'll hurt them a different way. P ground, oh yes, please. Gibnut, I have zero-day local root exploit against open webmail, and Tunisia's NIC servers run it. risala.ati.tn/cgi-bin/openwebmail/openwebmail.pl. If we can get into that server, we can root Tunisia's.tntld name servers and control its entire internet space. P ground, oh shit. Gibnut, redirect it all to WikiLeaks. P ground, shit just got real, dude, Gibnut. With this zero day, Gibnut is suggesting that they can compromise the domain name registrar in Tunisia, the NIC, and control the entire Tunisian top-level domain, TLD, namespace. An example of a TLD is .com or .org. Each country has its own TLD. Tunisia's is .tn. If the Anons can compromise this Tunisian registrar, they can redirect everyone who tries to navigate to a website that ends in TN to any server they wish. Gibnut lulzily suggests WikiLeaks. Although this particular exploit did not yield access, for unknown reasons, it did succeed in spreading an anxious optimism throughout the sidelines. Gibnut, let me see if I can get in. Be right back. P ground, arm the nuclear warheads, guys. Internet feds is going in. K-Rad, Gibnut, nice. But first we need to find a bug on there. Jaggy 91, epic. P ground, for some reason, stuff in this channel always ends up being epic. Jaggy 91, lol. Rubik, guess I'm going to have to use some PostgreSQL injection cheat sheet or something? Gibnut, Rubik, or download Havij for Windows. Krad, marshpublique.gov.tn is highly injectable. There's at least one vulnerability that allows an attacker to modify the site's database in ways other than intended. Stand by for lulz. Rubik, oh my god. Looks like Ministry of Justice, I think. I don't know. Krad, I don't know, but a lot of the sites are vulnerable. Like many hackers, if they don't know something, they go teach themselves. Krad, know that Postgres bug? Rubik, yeah. Krad, I did some reading on Postgres and learned me some database, so now I know how to inject it. Stand by for dump. Krad went away for a while, clearly working hard, then came back with some results. Krad accessed a database with 1,600 rows, and thus entries, and tried to crack the passwords. First apologizing, sorry guys, just taking time because I've never done PostgreSQL and I'm trying to write it into a script to make it faster as I do it. He then realized that the ongoing DDoS was what was causing the slowdown of the password dump. He implored, Krad, someone tell Op Tunisia, do not DDoS 193.95.68.156. It's fucking up my dump. As this was a team effort, other hackers were simultaneously trying to gain access through other potential security vulnerabilities. They realized that if they could get shell access, which enables a lower-level access to the system, they could potentially get the private emails of the Prime Minister of Tunisia and then leak them. Rubik managed to gain access, but unfortunately found nothing but spam. But that didn't stop the owning process. To own a server basically means that you have gained the top level of privileged access, and from there on out, you have free rein to do whatever you like with it. You can read any file, write to any file, change running processes, inject your own processes / malicious code, or, if you are so inclined, delete everything. You are root, the full administrator of the machine, even though you are nowhere physically near the machine itself. Inevitably, of course, the Anons defaced the site, but first they attempted to score some emails. Rubik: I logged it, but there's nothing there. K-Rad: Be right back, guys. I'm going to make a fresh tea. Gibnut: moshpublik.gov.tn/onmp/upload/upload_fichier.php?field=document?type=document. Shall I own it now or later? Rubik: Nice. K-Rad: Be best now while the anti-tuni.gov steam is still rolling. Rubik: We could upload a shell, I suppose. Gibnut: Target-rich environment. Rubik: Which shells would you guys like? I have like 40. K-Rad: It will maximize effect and morale. If we can root it, we need to go for email leak too. Not just deface. Full-on email leak. Rubik: Found the shell. Gibnut: moshpublik.gov.tn/onmp/upload/documents. K-Rad: Someone make a fancy payback deface page, please. As the team prepared to deface the page, K-Rad excitedly declared that there was an old kernel installed. The kernel is the core component of an operating system, the contact point between the hardware and the software. An old kernel usually means that there are some known exploits, so this is almost always a good sign for someone wanting to compromise a machine. Rubik: Here's a deface page. picthost.eu/images/0004/1986/anonymous-deface-tunisia.jpg. If you like it. K-Rad: Old kern for the win. Rubik: Root? Ducky: Not bad, Rubik. Any chance you could center the text at the bottom, though? Rubik: I don't know, I didn't make it. I'm running on Tor. Wish I had a VPN. Ducky had just logged in to help. He was eventually booted for lacking sufficient low-level hacking ability, but he was a skilled organizer and broker, so for the time being, he was allowed into the channel. He had a rare knack for naming operations and a rare level of insight into the ongoing changes affecting Anon-Ops. Ducky: Anything I can do to help which doesn't involve actually going into the server? Rubik: I've been in and out. This channel was presumed dead for a long time. K-Rad: Ducky, make a deface page. While Pound Internet Feds was in hot pursuit of the private emails of the Tunisian Prime Minister, there was another channel, Pound Op Deface, also hard at work. But even in the elite channel that was Pound Internet Feds, many were blind to the existence of Pound Op Deface. Meanwhile, the search for emails came up empty. On Pound Op Deface, Rubik gave a technical rundown of the exploit they had found on Pound Internet Feds. Some Tunisian Anons realized an exploit could work on another target. OT: I repeat, main target is ATI, Tunisian Internet Agency, direct responsible for censorship. Mo: I have found an XSS exploit on ATI site. A: OT, LOL, I just thought you said that in op channel, a public channel. OT: LOL, not that stoned yet. Rubik: We found admin login passwords for moshpublik.gov.tn, which is on the same box as pm.gov.tn now. VJ: I think we looked into Ministry of Communication as DDoS target. If it was disqualified, I don't remember why. A: Just looking at it. Rubik, thinking they might eventually score some juicy emails, asked them for some help. Rubik: By the way, can anyone prepare a statement for the torrent description when we get pm.gov.tn emails? For example, a message to pm.gov.tn about their leaked emails. But not yet. Prepare a deface page. Unless you like pichost.eu/images/0004/1986/anonymous-deface-tunisia.jpg, and prepare a torrent description or manifesto. Eventually, pound op deface delivered. VJ, greetings from Anonymous. We have been watching your treatment of your own people, and we are both greatly saddened and enraged at your behavior. You have unilaterally declared war on free speech, democracy, and even your own people. Your people rally in the streets to demand accountability and their own rights, which you have wrongfully presumed it was in your purview to take from them. We will use this brief span of attention we've captured to deliver a clear and present message which we hope shall never be forgot. Remember that the tighter you squeeze, the more your people shall rebel against your rule. Like a fistful of sand in the palm of your grip, the more you squeeze your people, the more that they will flow right out of your hand. The more you censor your own people, the more they shall know about you and what you are doing. We are Anonymous. We are the angry avatar of free speech. We are the immune system of democracy. We do not forgive censorship. We do not forget free speech. Expect us, always. A. Good stuff. I'd substitute citizens for people. Sounds more profound. VJ. We will use this brief span of attention we've captured to deliver a clear and present message which we hope shall never be forgot. Remember that the tighter you squeeze, the more your citizens shall rebel against your rule. Like a fistful of sand in the palm of your grip, the more you squeeze your citizens, the more that they will flow right out of your hand. The more you censor your own citizens, the more they shall know about you and what you are doing. In that spirit, we release to the citizens of Tunisia and to the world a cache of government documents. Hopefully, this will shed some light on what the government so desperately wishes to hide. Rubik continued to act as gopher between the two channels. With work done for now, he gave props to one of the team members. Not Sabu, by the way. Another Anon quickly berated this individual praise on ethical grounds, and K-Rad himself played the accomplishment down, a clear example of the self-effacing values at work in Anonymous. Rubik. Credit goes to K-Rad for this one. K-Rad. It was everyone in FIDS. Don't forget to rm-rf their admin login page, rm-rf being the command to delete a directory, and rm-rf everything else you can under those perms. Adnan, you guys done? A, don't forget Gibnut and whoever else worked in the background. OT, no names, lol, just Anonymous. A, well, a fucking course. But in here, people who are in here. Nessie, we in secret, though. A, is still okay, I guess. OT, dudes, believe me, the key of this is having zero ego. A, we were just giving kudos internally. OT, LOL. Alex, a fucking course. Gibnut, no names, please, my handle is hot. So there you have it, hackers at work. It is mundane, quintessential teamwork, but also awesome and hilarious, at least for those involved. I only quoted from two channels, but the work transpired across four different groups, maybe even more, and also likely on a collaborative writing pad where the press releases were written. And keep in mind that the public op Tunisia channels, Pound Propaganda and Pound Command, were doing something, whatever that might have been, at the same time. Many Anons were coordinating through private messaging as well. In short, there were so many tentacles that the idea of a leader calling the shots is laughable. Not a hive, as Anonymous sometimes calls itself. Not a structureless mass, nor a structured hierarchy either. But some modality of all of the above. Don't worry, I'm Anonymous too. As we have heard clearly, individuals can stand out among the rest for their abilities in any particular situation. In Op Tunisia, K-Rad was one of these standouts, but over time, individual contributions bleed into each other, and the individual is submerged. However, keeping this in mind, we can nonetheless see the value of viewing Anonymous from the opposite perspective, singling out a participant and his or her important hack for the purposes of upending another persistent misconception. By showcasing Tiflo's work on Optunesia and considering it alongside that of Adnan and Amamu, it will become apparent that the stereotype of the typical anonymous participant, white, middle class, libertarian, and politically naive, is nowhere close to reality. Tiflo, featured previously under a different pseudonym, is a talented programmer who joined Anonymous in the fall of 2010 and founded Pound Internet Feds as the secret hacking wing of AnonOps. For much of the autumn, Tiflo was Pound Internet Feds' keymaster, testing and vetting invited hackers with three technical questions. One of AnonOps' more prolific technical contributors, Tiflo had the clever idea to write an anti-phishing script during Optunesia. Phishing is essentially any method that is used to acquire personal and private details, usually login and password combinations or credit card information, by pretending to be something or someone trustworthy. A common technique is to send forged emails that appear to be coming from the target's email provider's help desk or from their bank, urgently asking you to reply with your username and password before your account is closed. A more sophisticated version contains a link, which, when clicked, installs a keylogger or other type of malware. People fall for phishing attacks at an alarming rate, making it a particularly lucrative technique. One computer science study of the technique concluded, experiments show a success rate of over 70% for phishing attacks on social networks. So it was unsurprising that the Ben Ali regime was using a phishing scam involving a malicious script to plunder the usernames and passwords to the social media accounts of Tunisian activists. Tiflo's idea was to come up with an antidote, a remove Tunisian government phishing script. Tiflo's script is a quintessential example of an artful hack. Given an elegant definition by Jude Millen, better known by her handle St. Jude, she once said, "Hacking is the clever circumvention of imposed limits, whether imposed by your government, your IP server, your own personality." Tiflo's hack was not technically sophisticated. He wrote the code in less than 10 minutes and could have done so in 30 seconds had he been more familiar with the underlying technology. It was clever simply because it identified a need, and it worked. Before he could even whip up the short program, he first had to get his hands on the offending script. To do so, he had to find a Tunisian willing to give him remote computer access using a piece of software called TeamViewer. In early January, he reached out to a Tunisian activist. With the exception of Tiflo, everyone's pseudonym has been changed. Tiflo. Ananti? Ananti. Tiflo, yes? Tiflo. Ananti, are you in Tunisia? Ananti. Tiflo, yes? Tiflo. Can you come on TeamViewer so we can locate the IP address the phishing scripts are running on so we can hack them? Of course, Anon-Tunisia asked the obvious question. Anon-T. Tiflo, how can I trust you? Shaka. Tiflo is very trustworthy. Ogle. Tiflo is a trusted member. A.A. Anon-T, I think various people can vouch for Tiflo and I'll be one of them. Since trust is really often just a matter of faith, Tiflo offered the soundest advice, and one person resorted to a dumb and offensive joke. Tiflo, Ananti, you can see everything I'm doing on your screen. If you don't like it, you can exit. Shaka, Tiflo is old school payback from the start. KO2, trust Tiflo, always after rape he gives you candy. Ananti, A, Tiflo, Shaka, okay, private message me. Tiflo was now able to write the script. It, quite simply, changed the functions in the government script so that they did nothing. A day later, after the script had been written, thrown online, and was in the process of being downloaded by the thousands, Tiflo and Anon-T convened again in private. Tiflo, hey. Still here? Anon-T, yes. Tiflo, come on TeamViewer. I want to see if the script works. Anon-T, good work. Well done. Thanks. Hey, I have news. Tiflo. Hey? Ananti. The Al Jazeera reporter will investigate phishing with Facebook, Google, and company. Tiflo. Nice. There is also an article about it here. thetechherald.com/article/php/201101/6651/Tunisian-government-harvesting-usernames-and-passwords explains it well. Ananti. Yes. I sent to several media last night. Tiflo. Nice. Ananti. I'm a reporter myself. Tiflo. Did you also send the anti-phishing script? Ah. Ananti. Yes, don't worry. I'm anonymous too. Ananti, a journalist, remains anonymous, but I had the fortune of eventually meeting Tiflo in London during July of 2013, 2 years after, nearly to the day, his arrest by the British Metropolitan Police. Tiflo pled guilty to one count of computer misuse, admitting to conspiring to hack numerous British and international organizations, including the Serious Organized Crime Agency, 20th Century Fox, and News International. Since he was a minor when caught, he got off with a light sentence of community service. It consisted, as he told me in an interview, of tagging clothes that people donated with price tags, putting them out on the shop floor, and redesigning the shop window displays. I had not spent a whole lot of time talking to Tiflo, certainly not privately. His name was a constant fixture on my screen, and on occasion we chatted, usually as part of a group conversation. Usually engaged in a mix of technical or philosophical conversations, he was eloquent and sharp as a tack. He could be a smartass, but not in a cruel way, and it was often in the service of a broader insight. Take, for example, the following conversation from March 2011 on an IRC channel for journalists called Pound Reporter. A journalist had just logged in for the first time and asked, "Reporter 799, how does this work? I'm very new to this." Tiflo, "Magic. Witchcraft." Reporter 799, "Ha ha. So when you give interviews, how exactly does that work?" Token, "Ask a question somebody will answer." Reporter 799, "Just in general on this forum?" Tiflo, "Well, the laws of physics will perform chemical reactions in your brain to decide a question. Then we'll move the muscles in your arms to push keys to represent your question. Then upon pressing the enter key, it will be transmitted through the tubes." "Yeah, you can just ask a question here." Token, "LOL, Tiflo." Reporter 799, "And just cited as anonymous group member?" Tiflo, "Most of us here have been involved in anonymous operations." Reporter 799, "That's encouraging." Tiflo, "What publication/news do you work for?" Reporter 799, "Freelance. I write for X and have my own blog. I'll send you a link." She sends it. Tiflo, "All right." Reporter 799, "So I guess I can start asking now?" Tiflo, "Not sure how a dating blog is relevant to this subject, though." Though he was often around, it was difficult to geographically place him. He was obviously a native English speaker, but that didn't narrow things down much. It never crossed my mind that he, like Adnan, might be a teenager. When he was arrested on July 19, 2011, and revealed to be a 16-year-old, shock rippled through Anonops. People were surprised because his fellow hackers considered him to be one of the smartest of the crew. Teamwork does not preclude the assessment of capabilities and skills. Since Tiflo was a minor at the time of his arrest, authorities could not release his name, only his age. I am ashamed to admit that when I found out he was British and 16, a picture immediately popped into my mind. It was not as off as the nihilists, anarchists, activists, lulzsec, anonymous 20-somethings who haven't talked to the opposite sex in 5 or 6 years, described by Michael Hayton, the ex-director of the CIA and NSA, in reference to those who would come to support Edward Snowden. What did come to mind was a pale waif whose wealthy parents thoughtlessly shipped him off to boarding school at a tender age. As it turned out, once he was 18, Tiflo was revealed to be Mustafa Al-Bassam, and pictures confirmed that he was not pasty white. He moved to London from Iraq with his family when he was 6 years old, fleeing Saddam Hussein. His father is a doctor, a general practitioner, so they are financially middle class. but they live in a poor, immigrant-heavy neighborhood in South London and have more of a working-class lifestyle. His parents, like many immigrant families, save instead of spend. When I prodded him about his background, he explained, somewhat uncomfortably, "We live in the bottom 1% areas in the UK, economically and socially." My first meeting with him in London was, unlike my first meeting with Adnan, tense and awkward, since we did not have hundreds of hours of chatting to connect us. The disconnect was likely magnified by the fact he had been out of the scene for a while. He had been banned from the internet for 2 years. Thankfully, the sun streaming in through the skylight, the UK was undergoing a rare sunny spell, helped soften the mood. We continued our conversation online. A recurring topic was the morality of the law, unsurprising given his personal experiences with the justice system. One day we discussed another young hacker, Aaron Swartz, ensnared by the American legal system. Swartz was a co-founder of Reddit, one of the most popular sites online. Swartz, at the age of 25, was facing decades in prison, 35 years, and up to $1 million in fines for downloading a cache of academic journal articles from JSTOR, the scholarly archive available to anybody on MIT's network. Had he been found guilty, it is unlikely he would have been jailed for that long, but the number of charges and the potential years in jail were used by prosecutors to leverage him into a plea bargain and accept a felony charge. What is even more remarkable is that he did not hack JSTOR's website at all, nor was JSTOR even pursuing charges. Sure, MIT had to expend some resources over the affair, but it was not in any way seriously harmed. The main prosecutor, Stephen Heyman, nevertheless had the audacity to compare the internet pioneer to a rapist and suggested he had systematically re-victimized MIT by not taking a plea bargain, as Ryan Riley of the Huffington Post put it. Perhaps he could have been found guilty of trespassing. He stashed a computer in a closet on campus and connected it directly to the MIT system. On a few occasions, the MIT network administrators had booted him from the network, certainly trying to prevent him from downloading more than a certain number of articles. But even if some of his actions were illegal or broke rules, from a moral standpoint, one could say that the downloading of academic articles, many of them researched and written using tax dollars, was wholly undeserving of a 35-year sentence and a felony charge, not to mention an expensive trial also paid for by taxpayers. Swartz, forlorn and overwhelmed by the prosecution, ended his life on January 6, 2013. One day, while chatting to Al Bassam about the case, I mentioned an article written by a professor, Hal Abelson, who had chaired a committee investigating MIT's role in the affair. Abelson absolved MIT and described Swartz as dangerously naive about the reality of exercising his technical power to the extent that he destroyed himself. Appalled, I responded on a popular tech blog, "The true naivety here was Abelson's. His failure to attribute any blame to the unfair, aggressive, and excessive federal prosecution, instead characterizing it merely as vigorous, was as appalling as using a descriptive word that one should reserve for a workout." Al Bassam replied, "Dangerously naive about the reality of exercising power, to the extent that he destroyed himself, is a statement that should be applied to the prosecution, not Aaron Swartz." Al Bassam, Tiflo, had experienced firsthand the force of the law knocking at his door, and did so after months of engagement in direct action for causes he believed in. It is not surprising that youthful sensibilities are the source of so much creative political energy. Such energy can be harder to sustain as one's idealism bumps up against the horrific realities of the problems plaguing our world, coinciding with the saddling of more and more day-to-day responsibilities. But if youthful idealism makes someone proceed in attempts to tackle the enormity of our problems, then we need more, not less, youthful naivete. Smashing stereotypes. Adnan, Tiflo, and Slim are three anonymous activists. Anonymous is not the white middle-class American boys' club of everyone's default imagination. Hard numbers are impossible to come by, but those Anons I have met and those unmasked by arrests are a motley bunch. Incidentally, motley refers to trickster clothing, the court jester's multicolored smock. If, in addition to these three men, we consider the cohort of hackers Al-Bassam worked with in Pound Internet Feds, and later Lulzsec, now known due to arrests, the heterogeneity becomes more pronounced. Among their ranks was a Puerto Rican, living in a towering public housing project of New York. He was also an occasional drug dealer and a foster father to his nieces. Two Irish chemistry students, one whose radical political views were influenced by a father who was a member of the Irish Republican Army who had been jailed for 6 years, a Scotsman who for much of his time in Anonymous lived on the remote Isle of Yell, and a 25-year-old man, Kayla, who served in the British military in Iraq and performed a female gender online. Something about the pseudonymous environment likely helped cultivate this cosmopolitanism. By cloaking markers of the self, like ethnicity, class, and age, all sorts of different possibilities are opened up. Studies confirm that we tend to seek those who are familiar or similar to us, and fellowship via shared identity is nothing to scoff at nor eliminate. Nevertheless, it is also important to create and experiment with spaces that mute markers of class, age, and background to help form connections that might not otherwise be made. In a way, it could be that self-defined membership in Anonymous itself becomes enough of a shared identity to foster these connections. While we can showcase surprising examples of diversity within Anonymous, this is not to say that heterogeneity is not notably lacking, particularly when it comes to gender. Although Anonymous boasted key female participants and organizers, like Dar, featured earlier in this book, and a feisty activist named Mercedes Hafer, whose actions will soon be examined in depth, the only feminon hacker in Lulzsec turned out to be a guy passing himself off as one, Kayla. Anonymous mirrors the structural inequities prevalent across the computer science world. While most of the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math fields have narrowed the gender gap, computer science is not one of them. Indeed, peak equity in college enrollment occurred more than 20 years ago, when 37% of undergraduate computer science degrees awarded in 1985 went to women. Today, the number hovers around 20%. And while numbers are harder to harvest for the hacking scene, given the informal nature of many associations, all indicators point to even lower rates of inclusion. In certain sectors, such as free and open source software, many projects have responded with initiatives to increase diversity. But among law-breaking hackers, the only females I have met or heard about are those who have switched genders, which is actually, and perhaps for many, surprisingly, more common than one might imagine. Conversely, it bears noting that, whatever the reason, females are more common among trolling communities. Even though there are no formal studies on gender and the hacker underground, the low numbers are likely the combined result of structural forces, the legal riskiness of the activity, and the insular, braggadocious boys' club mentality within the established community. Occasionally, hearing constant belittling of female contributions from certain anons, I would find myself wondering, is this sexism or just trolling? Knowing full well that the distinction is rarely clear-cut. Being specific about diversity and gender dynamics allows for more interesting questions to be posed. Why, for instance, are gender benders, queer hackers, and female trolls common and openly accepted categories, but female participation in technical circles remains low? Some identities become accepted, while others continue to be viewed with skepticism. Dismantling the stereotypes also allows a greater appreciation of the motivations held by many of these participants. We may disagree with the tactics, hacking, DDoSing, doxing, but we should distinguish these tools and their significance from the composition of Anonymous itself. Time and again, I witnessed participants acting with political conviction, and it is likely some of them were political newcomers. This becomes entirely lost if we understand Anonymous through the gross fetish of stereotypes. Many journalists who have interviewed me as an expert academic ask in some form or another about the kind of person who seems to get into Anonymous. Though it is not the answer anyone wants to hear, I often say that there is no kind. Except, again, that many tend to be geeks and hackers. Those who identify as being part of the internet are diverse in background, interests, and political sensibility. But behind the question, the asker likely has something in mind. Socially alienated, white, angry, libertarian, American youth. And if we assume the default hacker and geek is generally male, middle class, libertarian, and white, then it is much easier to treat a hacker's political interventions as juvenile and suspect, arising from a baseline of teenage angst, instead of the desire for politically conscientious action.